Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to another episode of the London Lyceum. I am one of your hosts, Leland Brown, and we are a podcast dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And we endeavor to create an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. In short, this means that we want to begin with our confession of faith, embrace that joyfully, let it serve as a foundation for our thinking. But sort of within that, we want to try to think well and be curious about and charitable towards the views of others who might have minor or even significant differences from us. We can sharpen each other and learn from each other, even while holding different convictions. And this perspective can lead to a lot of really fun conversations. It helps us engage with others of a variety of confessional perspectives. And a great example, if you're a regular listener, of this might be that while a lot of you are probably Baptist, you can still appreciate the theology and perspective and life of John Calvin, one of the great Protestant reformers. You know, we can disagree with him on some things and still really learn from him and love him. And that brings me to our guest on the podcast episode today, Dr. Tony Lane. He has published extensively on John Calvin and done a lot of great work on the Reformation doctrine of justification, as well as some more general overviews of Christian thought through the ages. He is currently serving as an editor or the editor for a new translation of Calvin's Institutes, which is forthcoming and which I'm real excited to ask him some questions about in just a moment. First, Tony, welcome to the podcast. It's an honor to have you here. First, just would love to hear a little bit about where you're serving right now and any projects you're excited about.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Leland. Right. Where am I serving now? Well, actually, that's easy to answer. Professor of Historical Theology at the London School of Theology. I actually joined the faculty there in 1973. And wow. 2008, I started easing back from full-time, sort of 80% initially. And now I'm retired, but more, I'm sort of contracted 10%. So I'm still active, but in a lesser way. So very boring. I've stayed in the same place pretty much my whole academic career.
Yeah. Wow. Well, actually, just before we jump into Calvin, I'd love to just pick your brain. Give us a tip on staying well where you are and anything you've learned from a long tenure in the same institution.
Yeah. Well, I think there are two things I'd say. One is that I know some people, I'm thinking of two specific ones, who when they arrive somewhere after about 2 years, they begin to get itchy feet. And after 7 years, they're desperate to go. And that's their temperament. And I mean, they both had good careers, but they just did a job. And after 7 years, they were done. And then they were on. I found after about 7 years, I was beginning to feel I got my feet under the table, you know, get my feet feeling at home. So there's partly that. It's a temperament thing and the type of person you are. But the other thing, and I think this is really important, if you're going to stay somewhere, or even if you're not, it's really important to keep good relations with people and not to hold resentments. Wherever you are, there are going to be decisions made you don't necessarily agree with. And I've seen some people who let that fester and they become embittered and so on. And that's really very sad. So you've got to take the rough with the smooth. You're not going to agree with everybody. Be forbearing. Accept that you don't always get your way in what happens. And that's great help for getting by.
Yeah, that's great counsel. I serve as a pastor at a church here in Charleston, South Carolina, and our senior pastor has been here now for 42 years. And I think he'd say something similar. Just learn to be where you're at. You can't always have your way. You know, it's great. Another thing you have a long tenure in is Calvin studies, and so I'd love to hear just first what first interested you in John Calvin, and kind of what has kept your attention over the years with him?
Yeah, thank you. Well, when I was a student in my early years, I had one friend in particular who was a very strong sort of Calvinist, which isn't quite the same as Calvin, but anyway, he sort of introduced me to the idea of Calvin. And for my 21st birthday party, I asked some old family friends to give me a copy of Calvin's Institutes. And I started reading them. And actually, I can remember what happened. I got to the first couple of sentences of the Institutes where he says, almost the whole of our knowledge of God is summed up in, our wisdom is summed up in the knowledge of God and knowledge of ourselves.
It's like page three, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I always gave that. I thought, this is ridiculous. This is just, you know, flannel. But then I read on. And now I come to appreciate that much more. So I, I got to enjoy him. And then when I passed from being undergraduate to doing PhD research, I got the opportunity to study Calvin then. And I've just enjoyed being with him ever since. Not that I agree with him on everything. I describe myself as a critical friend. I'm a great devotee of political biographers. And in my experience, the best ones generally are by people who are a critical friend. You know, if you're an enemy of somebody, it's hard to do them justice. If you're an uncritical friend, it just becomes propaganda. But the critical friend appreciates the other person, but can say, well, I think you got it wrong here, or this wasn't quite right.
Yeah, that's great. And just what a couple things that you are, man, I am with Calvin here. He's very insightful and helpful. And maybe where would be a couple of places where you'd be more of a critical or constructive friend of his?
Well, of course, I mean, one of the things to bear in mind is that Calvin is a child of his age. And so just to give one example, his view of church and state would be more like closer to what you have in Saudi Arabia, say, than what you'd have in America or Britain. And that was the world he was in. And so to expect him to have elements of liberal tolerance is just, you know, you're looking at the wrong time. I mean, his view was in Geneva, you had to, there's just the one church. There wasn't more than one church. You couldn't set up a little Baptist conventicle down the road. That was absolutely out of the question. So it was a very different world there. And related to that, I think he had two big faults. One he was aware of, tended to lose his temper, and he apologized on his deathbed for doing that. The other he wasn't aware of, and shared in common with a lot of people of past times, he was absolutely convinced that his way was God's way. So if you oppose his theology, his doctrine, you were opposing God. And today, I think most people see that as wrong. And I think it is, but it's quite a modern insight to see it that way. So I think we need to recognize there is a difference between what God says and what I say, or between what the Bible says and what I say, my take on the Bible.
Yeah. And do you think some of that would you say that's just sort of a pre-modern era disposition of some people, or a product of all the controversy during the Reformation, or just a personal characteristic of Calvin?
Right. I think it was a pre-modern thing, because in the Middle Ages, it would have been similar. However, the atmosphere was more febrile in the Reformation. And I think maybe, say, in the medieval schools, Thomas and Bonaventure could have discussed much more amicably than some of the reformers. I mean, Luther and Zwingli, for instance. So maybe the stakes were higher in the Reformation. And then your third point, I'm sure there's an element of that too. I think it was partly his temperament as well. So I think it's all three, actually.
Yeah, I have read Bruce Gordon's biography of Calvin, and kind of like you read Calvin, like I'm critical of his take on Calvin, but I appreciate a lot of it.
And I think that biography is absolutely excellent. I think I've read quite a few biographies of Calvin over the years, and I mean that one is in a class of its own. And, I mean, it really is very good.
Yeah, and I think one thing that Gordon talks a little bit about is how friendship with Calvin usually involved agreement with Calvin. And would you go as far as that? I mean, I found Gordon maybe a little overcritical of that in Calvin, but would you say that's generally true, that he generally
but not too much, because I mean, he makes a lot of his friendship with Melanchthon, although it wasn't a sort of like Luther's friend with Melanchthon. They'd go down and have a beer in the evening, you know, together. Yeah. The Calvins, I mean, their relationship, they did meet when Calvin was in Strasbourg, but it wasn't quite the same sort of intimate relationship. But I mean, he wrote a dedication, for instance, to the French translation of a work of Calvin, of Melanchthon's, in which Melanchthon puts forward a view on grace and free will, which would, I think, later on might be called Arminian, you know, and Calvin is prepared to write a commendation for it. So he wasn't completely inflexible, but possibly less tolerant of people who he didn't respect, who tried that on, as it were. Junior people, if you see what I mean.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's a... our heroes are fascinating, you know?
Yeah.
So in my hand, I've got this beautiful little book. It's published by Crossway called On the Christian Life. My understanding, it's a fresh translation of Calvin's golden booklet of the Christian life. If for readers unaware, that's just a section of the Institutes that has been famous for a really long time. And again, this for our listeners who love books, this is just a beautifully designed book. There's this nice engraving on the front. It's great to hold. But this represents a foretaste of a new translation project Crossway's doing on the Institutes. And Tony, you are the editor of that project. So I'd love to hear just how this project came about and just your thoughts about why we need a new translation on Calvin.
Okay, can I just back up first and say something about the booklet? It was actually Calvin who first had the idea because, I mean, his Institutes went through five main editions. And after the fourth one, the chapters on the Christian life were almost 100% complete. And at that point, Calvin published them as a booklet in its own right. Okay. So he recognized the freestanding value of those chapters. And so what we've done is we've given the not the one that he issued in 1550, but the fuller version, the version as it comes in the final Institutes. But I just wanted to make the point that we were doing what Calvin himself did. I think there was one other bit where he also published it separately, but he obviously regarded those chapters as really significant and valuable. Now, of course, we have a slightly different reason in that we, as you say, we saw this as a trailer for the translation to get people's appetites whetted 2 or 3 years before the thing comes out. So it has that function as well. So back to your original question, which you might like to repeat for the listener's benefit.
Tell us how the project came about and why a new translation of Calvin's Institutes is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, okay. The Battles translation it was published in about 1959-60. So that's 55 years. Sorry. 75 years.
I have five young kids at home.
It's 65 years. But anyway, by the time ours is published, it'll be 70 years or so. So it sort of had its lifetime. Now, some people involved in the project have got a huge list of all the mistakes in Battle's translation. And I'm sure that's true, but I think it would be vain to imagine you can produce 1,500 pages of new translation without making your own mistakes. So I'm sure our translation will have mistakes. My Latin isn't brilliant. I'm not the translator. Randy Blacketer, who's based in Grand Rapids, is doing the translation. But we also have Kirk Summers, who is a real Latinist. He is reading it, going through it, and as a backstop, if you like, picking up things where he questions the translation. So I suspect the process has probably been more rigorous than it was with Battles. So that's one thing. A new translation for a new century, but much more important than that, the really big drawback of the Battles translation is in the notes. And I'll just give you two main examples. Well, start with first of all, actually, even in the text, the biblical references. If you check the biblical references against Calvin, you will find they're completely different. Some of them are the same as Calvin. Some of Calvin's references have been dropped. And some of the biblical references were not given by Calvin. So there's nothing to warn you about this, but they are just two different sets of references. So that's not really as it should be. But okay, much worse. Yeah.
So in the kind of present version, the biblical references we'll see like cited are actually the translator's
references
and not Calvin's.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's some overlap, obviously, but by no means all of them are from Calvin, and by no means all of Calvin's are there.
Okay. That's important.
It is important. Yeah. We're scrupulous about that. Although we do have a rule. If Calvin gives a reference, say in the 1543 edition, and it's a correct reference, and then he drops it, we'll include that because we haven't invented it. But if he's manifestly quoting, say, from Romans 6, then if he hasn't given a reference, we'll put it, but in square brackets, to distinguish it from Calvin's reference. So we are very scrupulous about that. That's the first thing. The second thing, which is actually in a way much more serious, is if you read the look at the Battles translation and look at the footnotes, you might have a whole string of references to Augustine or Thomas Aquinas or so. And there is absolutely nothing to tell you whether those are Calvin's references or Battles and McNeil's references. And this really leads people astray, because at the time, they thought that Thomas Aquinas was like a sort of major figure that Calvin was interacting with. And it's full of references to Thomas Aquinas. And yet Calvin only four times ever mentions Thomas, and only twice in the Institutes. But I remember one Calvin scholar, very junior at the time, coming up in a discussion group and saying, look, he said, Calvin is constantly referring to Thomas, and he pointed to the footnotes and so on. And he didn't realize this wasn't Calvin referring to Thomas, this was Battles and McNeil.
There's probably a lot of theology and church history students who have done some very misguided papers on Calvin's use of the fathers.
Sure. And actually, to be fair to Battles and McNeil on this one, I should say I never met Battles, but I did. I've been in Grand Rapids a few times, including for 5 months, and got to know his widow very well. But anyway, to be fair to them, they drew it from the edition we've used for the translation, the Neasel, Bart Neasel edition of Calvin's Institutes, which is really very good. But in its footnotes, it does tend to refer to Thomas. It doesn't claim it. Calvin is referring to him. It's scrupulous on distinguishing Calvin's, whether it's biblical references or patristic or whatever. You have no question about what is Calvin and what isn't, and that's our model. But they do reference, make mention of Thomas quite a lot in the footnotes, and I think that was a misconception of the time. And Battles and McNeil simply run with that.
Yeah. So this, it sounds like it's going to be a great reference, not just in a fresh translation, but also just in better understanding of how Calvin understood and used scripture and appropriated previous figures.
And then there's another feature. What Randy has done is, as he's gone through with the translation, he's always consulted the French. And if the French is different or if it adds something, then he puts it in a footnote. One mustn't be misled by this, because sometimes the French is simply simplifying things for a lay audience, you know, whereas the Latin is for the professionals. But sometimes he explains himself more clearly. So it can be useful. But everywhere, you know, throughout the translation, that has been done. So in a sense, the reader is getting the benefit of what light the French translation can shed on Calvin's meaning.
Yeah, so just for readers not as aware, so there is a final Latin version of the Institutes, Calvin's final version. You guys are translating from a text. And how many French versions were there? Was it just one, or were there multiple?
No. Basically, the first edition, 1536, there wasn't a French translation, but there was a sort of catechetical work, which was vaguely similar. But then from 1541, the other editions, 1539, 1543, 1550, 1559. The other four editions, every time, soon afterwards, there was a French translation.
Okay.
And Calvin did it himself and regarded it as a priority. Not all the French translations of his works are by him. Some of the less significant works, other people did the translation. But we know for a fact that Calvin did the French translation of the Institutes.
Just off the top of your head, are there any particular places where the French particularly sheds light on the Latin? Or is that that's a complex question, but anything that stands out to you on that particular feature?
Not off the top of my head, no. I'd have to go back. And we're talking about small, subtle things about just perhaps spelling out a bit more fully what he meant. Nothing earth-shattering at all.
Okay.
Nothing earth-shattering.
Cool. I'd love to hear a little bit about y'all's philosophy of translation. So, you know, like in the world of translating scriptures, you've got a formal equivalent as close as we can get to the original language, even if it's clunky, to phrase by phrase, things that are in the middle that try to balance readability and accuracy. How are y'all working through that?
Yeah, well, of course, you really need to be talking to Randy about that. But I think on the whole, we aim to keep pretty close, not in a wooden way, but aim not, you know, to have a fairly close translation of the original. So definitely up that end of the scale.
Great. Anything else you'd like someone sort of interested in Calvin to know about this particular translation? Do you know when it's forthcoming? What other details do you have for us about it?
Randy's working to a schedule, and he's currently well through book four, which is encouraging. And he's scheduled to finish the whole thing beginning of 2027, so that's less than 2 years away. Now, with the Christian Life one, it went through quite a long editing process. There were three involved, myself and Randy, and somebody who actually was one of my PhD students. So he did a PhD on Calvin. He works with Crossway as an editor. And it was a very good, very well together, the three of us. But the thing is, I hope it'll be slightly faster with the whole thing, because what we were doing is we were working out some of the ground rules for that, you know, when we did the Christian Life one. And of course, those are now fixed, so we won't have to go through all that again. So, I would imagine probably that editing process would take a year. I'd be surprised if it was less, because and again, Kevin is a very painstaking editor, and this is something you want to get right in a way that if you're just writing a novel, it's far less significant. But here, when you're dealing with translation of somebody, you want to make sure you get it really accurate and convey fairly what he's saying. I would guess, let's say, roughly a year, sometime in 28, and then hopefully it would appear in 29. So we're probably talking of almost 4 years.
They will release it as a single volume, or do you know if they're going to release parts of it as they come available? Or
Well, the parts as they come available has just been done, in if you see what I mean, in the thing on the Christian Life. Yes. But then as far as I'm aware, the rest will just be at the end. It'll all come out together. Yeah, okay. Probably, I think, in two volumes. Yeah.
Great. And just particularly on the book that's been released on the Christian Life, obviously, I've read this a few times and some of our readers probably have. Anything particularly about Calvin's vision for the Christian life that you find compelling or that you really are drawn to?
Yeah, indeed. What I mentioned in the introduction, the principles, especially of Calvin in general, and especially of those particular chapters, I think have an awful lot to say to us about the whole question of lifestyle, simplicity of lifestyle, and so on. And this isn't original to me, but I heard a talk by Michael Ronald Wallace, who was, I mean, he's not alive, he'd be well into his hundreds by now. He was a pastor and a scholar, and wrote a number of books on Calvin in the maybe the 60s, 70s, that sort of time. And he gave this talk in which he brought out five principles from these chapters. And these five principles, I think, make an excellent guide to this whole question of lifestyle and simplicity and otherwise. And I've written a separate piece on that. And I'm basically developing the 5 points that Ronald Wallace brought out. And I really think they provide principles that are general enough that they can be applied, whether it's to 16th century Geneva, 21st century South Carolina, or 21st century Africa, say. If you have a sort of legalistic approach, then it becomes very dated very quickly. When I was growing up, there was a time, when people said, well, of course, if you're a Christian, you can have a black and white television, but not a color television. That's too much. Exactly. We laugh now. I mean, it's just laughable. So these things, those sort of things change and change very quickly. Again, I remember when having a mobile phone or a cell phone, as you call it, again, was a mark of luxury. Whereas now, I mean, even the poor, many of the poor in Africa will have a smartphone and so on. So, I mean, these things change very quickly. But the principles, the same principles, can remain pretty constant.
And what's the article title that you wrote on this?
Right. Well, it actually came out as a chapter of a book. I wrote a book on sin and grace, and it's in historical perspective, and one of the chapters is on that. I don't think it's come out separately from that. I did it at a conference, but I don't think the papers from the conference ever got.
Do you Now, you've published so much, you may not have this, but what's the title of the book for interested readers?
It's called Sin and Grace.
Oh, Sin and Grace. Okay, great.
That's the title of the book, yes.
Okay. Fantastic. And so when you say simplicity, are you referring specifically to like a simple perspective or like materialism and embracing simple life as regards to our possessions?
Yeah, as a, how you should handle possessions and so on. Yes, possessions, wealth, and so on. And what is a Christian approach to that? And I mean, basically, Calvin sees as steering a middle path between license and luxury on one hand and legalism on the other. And these are. Can I maybe just give you the 5 points?
That'd be super helpful. We'd love to hear those things.
Yes, I mean, it is very, I think, in my view, they are very helpful. Just get simplified. Okay. So the 5 points that Calvin brings out in these chapters, his 5 principles, are first of all, to be detached from this world. And that is incredibly difficult because we, all of us, are so much involved in the things of this world. And to have a detachment from them is quite something. And he even talks about despising them compared with what's to come. But then he talks about use of the things of this world, but without enslavement. So to be able to use things, use the money we have and so on to do things, useful things like technology and so on, we can use it without becoming enslaved to it. And then moderation rather than legalistic asceticism and stewardship, recognizing that everything we have is entrusted to us by the Lord. It's not ours, but it's ours for the common good. I gather the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, the auditors of Leicester said, the trick is to stop thinking of it as your money. And in a sense, that's the principle of stewardship. It's not our money, it's God's, yeah. And we're entrusted to it. And then the last principle is generosity, not 10%, generosity. And I think those 5 principles really are excellent in any context in helping to steer you through the situation.
And I would say, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like Calvin himself is a pretty good example of this. I mean, there's passages where he's like, everybody knows I don't have like super nice clothes, but he'd also play recreational games on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon and sort of embrace the world.
Yeah. And he was generous as well. Yes. No, I mean, I think he lived by those standards. Not perfectly, of course, none of us do, but he did pretty much live the way he spoke, you know, where he preached.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, and that's definitely a way Calvin's helpful for us just kind of navigating our world. What other ways would you say, just Calvin in general, could be this particular work or whatever, how else would you say he's important or relevant in 2025?
Yeah, well, he's relevant. Well, I mean, I think in so many ways, he's one of the figures who towers over Christian history, and his influence is there. It is important to distinguish between Calvin and Calvinism. So, I mean, the tulip, I mean, that goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, although the ideas go further back. But I don't actually think Calvin held to all 5 of them anyway. So it's important to distinguish between Calvinism and Calvin. But Calvin has a lot to teach. You know, just he was such a profound thinker, and just going back to him and his insights, they're still very relevant, I think, and still very, very stimulating. Recognizing that his context is very different to ours.
Yeah. So you bring out an important point. There's a movement, I think, in Great Britain as well, but especially in America, like the Young, Restless, and Reform movement. And one of the hallmarks was, you know, all these guys are Calvinist. They believe in tulip. So tell us, and you said that Calvin didn't necessarily affirm all 5 points explicitly.
Yeah.
Tell us just how Calvin might be nuanced from how we might think about Calvinism what differences might be.
If we talk about Calvinism, I mean, what is meant by Calvinism? I mean, on the one hand, it's Richard Muller. I don't know if you've come across him. I mean, he's written quite a lot in this. He makes the observation is that perhaps if a Calvinist is someone who believes exactly as Calvin did, then there has only ever been one Calvinist in history. And that's true. But then Calvin, you know, Lutheranism is a whole stream of Reformation, Protestantism. And to be a Lutheran, you don't have to agree with Luther on everything. And that issue blew up already in the 16th century because Melanchthon, and Luther, they were friends and colleagues, but they didn't see eye to eye on everything at all. And likewise with Calvinism, if there's Calvinism in the sense of reformed Christianity, I mean, Arminian was a reformed theologian. And that brings us on to the third point here. That is that simply to identify, and Richard Muller again brings this out, well, simply to identify one set of doctrines as what makes you a Calvinist or not, namely the Tulip doctrines, is completely anachronistic. You know, why not say, do you hold to Calvin's view of church and state and think that the church, that there should be only one church in the city and that and everybody has to belong and so on? Or is it fidelity to his view of baptism? You know, why single out, or the Lord's Supper, why single out predestination, where he was actually rather less distinctive in his time than on some of these other, some other doctrines? So, I mean, simply identifying certain doctrines to do with predestination as what makes you a Calvinist is, okay, that's the way the word is often used. But, I mean, that's not being, that's being very arbitrary in terms of, it's just one part of what Calvin taught and a part that he shared with most of the other reformers. Pretty much all of the other reformers, except for Melanchthon, sort of strayed a bit.
Yeah. It's interesting how history is. I mean, Calvin is known for predestination and Michael Servetus, you know, unless you study him more, and really his perspective in theology is much richer than that. And just now you've got me curious. Would you say that, you know, even though it's anachronistic, would you say Tulip generally represents Calvin's soteriology, or would he
Let's just
be different from that, or have some nuance versus the way we articulate it today?
Yep. Okay. Total depravity. I mean, he uses that word, that phrase. That's fine. Unconditional election. I mean, no problem. Limited atonement. Again, Calvin, the debate came up a little bit after Calvin's time, but I think for Calvin, it's very interesting. At the end of book two, he talks about the work of Christ. And the beginning of book three, he says, what Christ has done for the salvation of the whole world is useless until we're united to him by the Holy Spirit. And the selectivity comes there. And just to give another example, Mark 10:45, Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Okay, many, you see, it doesn't say all, but Calvin's gloss is many, i.e. everybody.
And that's in his commentary on Mark or the Harmony of the Gospels, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So irresistible grace, that is, I think, a very unfortunate term, which neither Calvin nor Augustine used. They talked of things like efficacious grace. And the reason why I think it's a bad term, I mean, the idea is the same, but the reason why it's a bad term is just imagine that the sentence, I found him irresistible. He was irresistible. I couldn't resist him. That could come in two contexts. One is, I fell madly in love with him. The other could be, he raped me, being blunt. Mm. And that's what the problem with the word irresistible. It conveys the wrong impression, or can do. It can be read in that wrong way, whereas efficacious grace is the grace that wins us over, that that gets us, achieves its goal. And the last point, perseverance of the saints. Yes, I mean, he was pretty much in agreement with that. Yeah.
Your point about the eye and Tulip is interesting. I mean, it's kind of like, if a pastor has a great acronym for a sermon, but that one word doesn't necessarily, but you would say, Calvin would say that when God acts in salvation, he does so sovereignly and his people respond, but it's not in a way that sort of forces us or makes us robots or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it is. I mean, neither Calvin nor Augustine used, I can't say they never absolutely ever use, but I think it might even be true they never actually use that word irresistible, but they use other words like efficacious and so on, sovereign grace and that sort of thing, which I think is a better way of putting it. It's not a difference of, it's just the ambiguity and the way the word irresistible can come over if you're not careful.
Yeah. That's super helpful. Just thanks for your insight there. Another just general Calvin question, and this is sort of a perennial question in Calvin studies, but would you say there's any sort of key or overarching themes in his theology or any inconsistencies? And just for listeners, I shared with Tony earlier that I had a comps question in my PhD program about the center of Calvin's theology, and the answer was everyone fights about this. It's a debated thing, and it's hard, and such a great theologian, but what would you say on those questions?
Yeah. I mean, in the 19th century, they came out the idea of a central controlling principle in Calvin's theology, and that was a very 19th century way of doing it, where somebody got a key idea and worked it through remorselessly, regardless of what the Bible teaches and so on. And Calvin didn't operate that way. He was offering an ordered, is he a systematic theologian? Yes, in the sense that he was setting out an orderly presentation of the Christian faith, topically arranged and so on. No, in the sense that he wasn't working it out from some central philosophical principle or from some controlling principle. So in the 19th century, the idea was put forward that predestination was the controlling principle, or the sovereignty of God was the controlling principle. But no, it's not how he operated. Now, when it comes to where the action is today more, is when it comes not to the theology as a whole, but to the theology of salvation, soteriology. Calvin, I think the idea of being united with Christ is fairly central to his thinking. And I think you can argue, and I would argue very strongly, that the core to it, well, to go back to what I was saying just now, what Christ has done on the cross for the human race is useless until we're united with Christ. But when we're united with Christ by the Holy Spirit, then from that flow of things like being justified, being sanctified, being adopted children of God and so on, and it all flows from being united with Christ. But it's not the controlling principle of his theology, but it is pretty central to his view of salvation. I think that's true.
And that's helpful. And how would you say Calvin conceived of union with Christ? Obviously, like spiritual union, but how'd he flesh that out?
Yeah, it's a very good question, actually. What did it mean to be? Well, I think you have to start in the sense with the contrast between being in Adam and in Christ. You know, so being in Adam isn't the case of having a deep spiritual relationship with Adam. It's in the case of, you know, it was our natural condition. And then being in Christ, it's almost like sort of changing nationality. But of course, there is the question of our, if you like, our subjective intimacy with Christ. And there's that side to it as well. And so I think it's a very rich idea that has a range of meanings. But I think the basic idea is you go from being in Adam to in Christ, and Christ and his benefits become ours because we're united with him. And then the union with him leads to a relationship and all the other things and so on, a communion with him, etc.
That's helpful. So just we're getting a little close to time. I'd love to just, I read a little bit about you, Tony, and I saw that you are a bit of a polymath, that you have a variety of interests just outside of Calvin and the Reformation, some computer science, photography, things like that. So tell me, just, is there anything sort of outside of the historical theology world that you are working on right now or excited about or kind of into?
Well, my studies have been almost entirely, in the sense of writing, I've been almost entirely in the area of historical theology, although I sort of, in a sense, dabble a little bit in systematic theology, not in the very technical sense, but in the sense of not seeing historical theology, not just as what happened in the past, but also what we can get from it today and so on. In terms of interest, the things you mentioned there, they're more at the level of outside interests and so on. And mm-hmm. I do love reading political biographers. And I've actually just finished reading the possibly the greatest modern biography there is. I don't know if you know what I'm referring to.
No, tell me.
Yeah. No, well, I was at a conference recently, and there's this chap there who teaches theology at Aberdeen in Scotland. And I realized from his accent, he didn't originate from there. So he asked him where he came from, and he said he was originally from Texas. And I said, oh, I've just been reading, just about to finish reading the greatest modern biography. Oh, he said, Robert Caro. It's the biography of Lyndon Johnson. 4 volumes, about 1,000 pages each, big pages. And there's a 5th volume on the way if he lives long enough. And I found it absolutely gripping. It is, he really reveals Lyndon Johnson. And I mean, it is an extraordinary piece of work. I found it, despite its huge length. So political biographies, especially the masters. And I quite enjoy photography and putting together photo books of places, been to family events and so on.
Well, that's super fascinating. All the way from Calvin to Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah? That's right. Yes. Yes.
That's great. Well, just want to thank you so much for being on the podcast today. For our listeners, just the On the Christian Life is available for purchase at Crossway's website. Again, it's a preview to a larger version of a fresh translation of Calvin's Institutes coming out in a few years. We'll just commend it to all of you. Thanks for listening to the only Baptist confessional analytic podcast on the planet. Till we meet again, stay Baptist.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.